CliffCentral.com.
All right, everybody, listen. We live on a fascinating continent, and I've been trying in the last while, and there are plenty of really good books about this, but I think this one might be the most interesting for a number of reasons. Obviously, I know the authors, one probably better than the other in terms of what they've already written, both very, very adept, eloquent, erudite men who've traveled far and wide. They're like sponges. They manage to absorb all kinds of interesting major stories, minor stories, little side branches, cultural observations, things about Africa that I think will titillate and sometimes traumatize the people who read this book. But I think it's all part of the fascinating tapestry that makes Africa such an exciting part of the world. And that's not some glib comment. It really is something I believe in, which is why we've been talking so much in the last couple of weeks to people who've written books about Africa and people who've observed various things about this continent. I think that we're on the cusp of being, as the first world turns into a kind of milquetoast version of what it was 20, 30 years ago, Africa is developing into a lot more exciting a venue for all sorts of things. Not only the kinds of economic development that we see forecast for Africa, but also the kinds of things that our people here are able to come up with because of our very unique challenges. So without further ado, I think let's get straight into it with the two guys who we've had on the show. I've certainly spoken to Richard not so long ago, Kevin Bloom and Richard Poplack. They've written a book called Continental Shift, and this morning they're here to talk to us about it. So good morning, everybody. How are you, Richard? How are you, Kevin?
Good, thank you. Great to be here.
Excellent. Nice to see you. Did you approve of my introduction? I mean, it's difficult to summarize some of the stuff, you know, without becoming a little bit flowery.
I give it 99.7%.
Oh, that's very nice. That's about the percentage that I got that I'm likely to vote for Bernie Sanders, given the choice in America.
There you go.
What do you think of where we're at in Africa at the moment? You've written this book. Let's go straight into the hard part of this. After looking at the volume of evidence and the volume of experience that you've gained on this continent, how are we looking? A couple of years ago, there was a lot of Afro-pessimism. Then it turned to huge Afro-optimism. Now, I feel like there's a bit of a lull in the enthusiasm about Africa. But that's not necessarily accurate.
Look, I think our book was kind of a huge fuck you to any of these Africa rising or Africa sliding or Africa disappearing or Africa, you know, purple or whatever, you know, whatever these bumper stickers that, you know, to a large degree, it's sort of this notion of selling emerging markets.
Yeah.
That was behind a lot of the whole Africa rising, sort of faux optimism. That said, there's a lot to be optimistic about, but this is a complicated continent.
Sure.
I mean, Botswana is very different from Senegal. You know, making a blanket sort of statement about sub-Saharan Africa, it's rising, it's failing. Looking at the GDP figures, the sort of growth figures that were around 5.5% from the 15-year period we looked at, we looked very closely at Africa from 2000 to 2015, and we're on the road on and off for about 10 years of that.
Mm.
Looking at Africa through the lens of its GDP growth is lunacy. So I think what this book really is an attempt to cut through all of that nonsense and look at 10 countries very closely and 10 themes very closely, and an attempt to dissect what is happening in these places and to communicate how complicated things on the ground actually are.
All right. What are the 10 countries? Let's start with that. And then I want to ask Kevin what he thinks of what you've just said, because I think you probably disagreed about some stuff in the book as well. You have to put together something cohesive.
We had our disagreements. I'm going to try and get to the 10 countries.
Right,
we did look at South Africa. We looked at Namibia, Botswana, Zimbabwe, the DRC, Ethiopia.
Nigeria. Central African Republic, South Sudan.
And Kenya. Yeah. And we traveled to about another 8 or 9.
There were 6 countries on the cutting room floor. Didn't make the book.
Yeah. Did you just throw them away because there wasn't enough info? There's too much, and you had to
bad Zambia. No, there was just so much.
Yeah,
just so much info.
You couldn't write a 23 volume episode on this, right?
No, but we wrote a polished million words to get down to this book. So we pretty much wrote 10 of these books. in order to get down to this one. There's just so much out there.
First of all, what's it like, Kevin, collaborating? Because both of you have written lots of stuff individually. And to write something together, I'd imagine, is some ways it's better because you can both get on with it and write stuff. But putting it together, it might be kind of harder because you've now got to decide whose stuff stays and goes. When it comes into the edit, there's bound to be you feeling precious about your stuff, Richard feeling precious about his stuff. You know, maybe you'll contradict each other, then something, you have to choose a line.
There's a big story behind that. For 2 years, we had a structure on this book that had an omniscient voice, a sort of third-person narrator.
Who was that, God?
That was God. We had God.
The Jewish God.
He was the Jewish God. I don't know. And we had a K voice, which was me writing in the first person, and an R voice, which was Richard writing in the first person.
Uh-huh.
And we stuck with it for a long time. I mean, there were some interesting weeks doing that. But, you know, what we thought was if we came with these three voices, it would be a structure that contained Africa's complexities, that we'd be able to show that Africa wasn't necessarily one thing. The problem turned out to be that we're two Jewish boys born in 1973 within 3 kilometers of one another. So the voices were not different enough. Huh. And we had to, we were at about 70,000 words when in mid-July 2013, we had a collective breakdown and had to throw all those words away. It just wasn't working.
You threw the whole thing away?
The whole thing.
Ugh.
We used a couple of paragraphs in the version that you're seeing in Continental Shift now, but we started again. It just wasn't working. We needed to put the notebooks first. We were writing out of fear, Gareth. I mean, this is a really big continent. And when we decided to do this, we'd stand on my balcony in Kalani and sort of look north out to the Magaliesberg and think, we're going there, we're going to do this thing. And we'd drink quite a bit of whiskey to drink through the fear that we were going to do this thing. And we wrote.
Is that just because it's intimidating to write a book about something so vast and so complex?
It's completely intimidating.
You thought, who are we to write about Africa,
exactly,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I got you.
We still think that.
Yeah. Mm. We do still think that. So, you know, when we threw these 70,000 words away, there were about 3 weeks where we were done. We were thinking about how we were going to go back to our publishers and say we're done, how we were going to tell our wives we were done because they had backed us for sort of three years.
They thought you were writing a book.
They thought we were writing a book. Yeah, but more importantly, we had interviewed.
We were just drinking whiskey, fucking around.
Yeah,
we didn't get anything done.
Yeah, yeah. But there were about 400 people who had interviewed at that point, and who had been to 12 countries, and I mean, we couldn't throw it away.
No, you can't. You can't abuse people's trust like that.
Yeah.
Sorry, we couldn't make it work. Yeah. Thanks for your time. We're done.
Plus, you have to pay back your advance.
We had to pay back
that
advances.
Wasn't going
to
happen.
Yeah. Yeah. we're going to go on the run
because you drunk up the advance.
Exactly.
We were going to go on the run. Yeah, and it wasn't just the publishers; it was like funders as well. And
but Richard, you just said it took you 10 years of kind of travel to give you the context, in which to write very specific stuff. The problem I find with a lot of South Africans, and that's why books like this are instructive and useful in a way that maybe other nonfiction isn't, is that we're in this continent. So few South Africans, black and white, ever go outside of here, except if it's for a 1 or 2 day business trip, or if they're one of those hippie tourists on a bicycle that's, you know, traveling from Zambia.
Or they're canoeing around Lake, you know, I don't know.
Titicaca in Peru. Or you know, I mean, that's a different continent, but you get the basic idea.
You're sand surfing through Namibia.
Yeah. Going fishing at Lake Malawi. Mm. It's not really, it doesn't give you any kind of intel about what's really going on.
No. So, I mean, this was a huge issue for Kevin and I. And what we felt one of our blind spots were when we first sort of started to conceive of this project was the fact that we actually view our own continent through a Western lens.
Mm.
Kevin and I write both both locally and internationally. Both editors in South Africa, black or white, and editors elsewhere in the world, black or white, were asking for the very, very Western story. So what's happening with AIDS? What's happening with conservation? How are the rhinos doing? you know, all of these stories. What's
conflict.
The latest war?
Conflict.
The war, you know. And everything had to be framed through this notion of being a conflict reporter. So when you're a conflict reporter, what you're reporting on is conflict. So if you go into Botswana,
have either of you ever owned one of those sleeveless jackets with lots of pockets that all the journalists, the conflict reporters?
I don't know what you're talking about.
You obviously have one. Did you ever have one full of pens and hand grenades and tissues and bandages?
We don't do boilerplate journo.
Really? You know? None of that Christian Amman poor stuff?
We go out in pressed Italian suits.
Okay, I'm so impressed.
With gorgeously polished wingtips. No, none of that.
Although there is a picture of you in Afghanistan holding an AK-47 wearing one of those. Or is it not one of those?
That was a Woolworths linen shirt I was wearing.
Okay.
Yeah, you could shoot pretty easily through one of those. So Gareth, this was like extremely important to us when we set out to start saying, okay, listen, put all that stuff aside. Let's reframe our relationship with how we report on this continent, and let's see what we see when we start doing that. And the world just opened up.
All right. It's a different point of view.
100%.
When you travel around Africa, though, isn't the temptation to always look for those stories? To look for the reasons why, for example, you know, I don't know, Bujumbura has the shittiest little airport, or this one's trying to kill this one in Senegal.
Well, you know, I mean, let's take the Central African Republic.
I mean, isn't it a terrible clusterfuck? Is the first question anyone will ask you.
Well, we went there to understand what a clusterfuck was. I mean, this is a country that's bottom of 7 out of 10 of the UN Development Indicator.
How do we itemize a clusterfuck?
Exactly. Is a clusterfuck? It's bottom, you know, it's the poorest country on earth.
Yes.
And you land at the airport there, and Africa's biggest refugee camp is right next to the only runway at the airport. And next to the refugee camp is a massive French garrison. So the reason for the clusterfuck, you can see before you've even landed.
Yeah.
And it's got a lot to do with the French.
Uh-huh.
When you start moving through that country.
What are the French doing in the Central African Republic?
Well, that's diamonds. The big question.
Diamonds. Yeah. The resources. And they'll tell you they're there to...
Are we still looking for diamonds? Can't we manufacture diamonds now?
Well, creating chaos. Yeah. Creating, yeah. Sowing the chaos creates the conditions to make a hell of a lot of money. Because this Western media thing that Richard's been talking about. I mean, this might sound conspiratorial, but it's fucking true.
Uh-huh.
The Western media is interested only in the conflict in the Central African Republic. While that and they're not going to be covering it that much. That's going on, go in and get the diamonds.
Clearly, South Africa is too. We had troops stationed there not so long ago.
We did, and don't forget, 13 South African servicemen lost their lives in the battle for Bangui in 2013.
And nobody really is sure why we were involved or how or what was to our advantage in this situation.
Well, the only thing we really know is that there was some Chancellor House investments. So that's the ANC ANC's investment wing in some projects up in the Central African Republic, and that we were a part of the African alliance that was that was meant to stabilize what was happening up there. Why we were there?
Here's the really sad thing about the Central African Republic is there's a market outside Bangui, the capital, called PK12. And
even their market just has a designation. It doesn't even have a name. They could have called it the Mabali Market or the Gareth Market, but it has PK12.
684-7322. Everything's a symbol.
Yeah. There you go. 6 years ago, the Muslims and the Christians in this market had no problem with each other. And that they hadn't had a problem with each other since Bangui was formed. Uh-huh. Sort of, you know, 80
what
years
happened?
Ago. What happened is that the 10th parallel cuts through Central African Republic. The French pushed all the Muslims north of the Waka River, which is on the 10th parallel, and let the Christians stay in the south. This is a manufactured war that didn't exist 6 years ago.
The French president, François Hollande, came to Bangui twice and said, we are not going to separate the population. We're not going to balkanize this country, while they were balkanizing the country. Because the easiest thing to do is just move people out along ethnic lines. Kevin is 100% right. 10 years ago, there was no...
6 years ago.
Yeah. A Central African Republic citizen would not know whether really he was Muslim or Christian.
And now that is the defining characteristic of 100%. Everyone above a certain imaginary line.
Right.
And everybody below a certain imaginary line.
And it's not just the Central African Republic. It's Nigeria, it's South Sudan. The 10th parallel divides across the world.
And then conflict is a self-fulfilling prophecy because you're putting people into boxes. They start to believe they belong in boxes and they hate people in other boxes.
Exactly.
Right. And that's a hangover of colonialism because effectively the old divide and conquer rule is still very much in play.
But what is François Hollande doing? What does he want out of there? You're telling me it's about diamonds?
Well, it's not. It's about resources. It's about stabilizing a geopolitical center. The center of Africa is very, very important to the French and their military program there. And again, it's not just the media who were conceiving Africa in terms of conflict. It's the West as well. They've come here and they've said, okay, this is a potential conflict zone. Let's treat it as such.
But forgive me. This does at this point sound very conspiratorial. And it does sound to me like there isn't really an advantage to anyone in having to get involved in this. Why the French would be interested in geopolitical stability in Central Africa?
Terrorism.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. So Operation Barkhane, which is run out of Chad, necessitates the French to stabilize Chad. In order to stabilize Chad, you have to make sure that the Central African Republic is behaving in a certain way that pleases Chad, right? So there are all of these very, very narrow geopolitical concerns that start swirling around. When you speak about it over the radio like this, it sounds a little conspiratorial. When you're on the ground, it's just how it is. These are the games that are being played right now.
Okay, so now Muslims and Christians are at war with each other in 100%. The Central African Republic, and before they weren't. So France's idea of how to stabilize the area has turned into how to destabilize the area. They've failed dismally.
Oh, 100%. So and the country has effectively balkanized.
And they're a complete anarchic system at the moment, right? I mean,
you've got stories now of the UN mission there being accused of mass rape.
Raping children. Mm.
Oh, okay. Let's just go, stop. And the UN in Africa... Since we're talking now, before we get into individual countries, the UN in Africa is probably doing more damage than it is good. Is that a fair thing to say?
Absolutely. I mean, Richard and I landed at the Bukavu. It was the Bukavu Strip.
Mm-hmm. Where's that?
It's northeastern DRC. Mm-hmm. It's the biggest UN mission on earth, and it was formed in the late 90s, where you had 1.5 million refugees passing out of Rwanda into the eastern DRC in 2 days. It was something like 40,000 human beings every 30 seconds were passing over this border. So you've got this instant refugee camp of 1.5 million people that springs up overnight. And what effectively goes on is that the Hutu genocidaires, who were, you know, the guys committing with machetes in Rwanda, now take control of this refugee camp. And all of the international aid, the food boxes, the medicine boxes
that are coming,
is controlled by them. The only international NGO to pull out was Medecins Sans Frontières.
By the way, in this refugee situation, were those people Hutu and Tutsi, or were they only Hutu?
They were mainly Hutu. They were mainly Hutu. But here's another thing that happened. While this refugee camp is formed, Paul Kagame is funding Laurent Kabila to drive west across the DRC to get rid of Mobutu Sese Seko. On the way, 250,000 Hutus living in the DRC are killed. And it's a story that doesn't make the international press. Why?
Because it doesn't follow the main storyline.
It's
inconvenient.
The Clinton administration are fucking embarrassed that they let 800,000 get killed in Rwanda, and now they're backing Paul Kagame.
Not anything more than embarrassed, but they're embarrassed.
They're embarrassed.
You know,
they're embarrassed. So this refugee camp
40,000 people dying is an embarrassment.
800,000 people to them dying was an embarrassment.
That's it.
Yeah, that's all.
So this refugee camp remains. It's the biggest UN mission on earth. It's still there.
And how? How are the UN supposed to do good there? I mean, would it not be better for them to just clear out and say, I'm sorry, we've clearly not helped you, but we won't aid and abet more destruction and stupidity. Let's just get out and quit while we're ahead.
Well, when Richard and I were walking around the streets of Goma as white guys who had sort of come out of this compound with our green notebooks, all of the little motorbikes, the little border borders, were going straight at us. And we couldn't understand why. This hadn't happened to us across Africa.
And
these guys were riding straight at us because they wanted us out.
Yeah.
They thought we were part of the UN and they wanted us out. The animosity is off the charts. They've been there for about 15 years.
And the UN has not helped anybody.
No, not over there. So to give you an idea, first of all, in the DRC, there's no real racial animosity.
Yeah.
Only in Goma did we experience the fact that they wanted white people out. They wanted white people out. But we're in South Sudan in Unity State, which is kind of the center of the civil war right now. That's the
We're jumping around a bit. I like this. But we're, okay, so we've now flown from Goma to South Sudan.
It's a lovely trip. Yeah. All right. So South Sudan in Unity State.
What kind of vehicle do you take there? Yeah. Is it, what kind of plane is this?
A hover bat plane. Yeah, that's it. No, so we fly internally wherever we are.
How do you book your ticket? Do you run up to a counter and throw down your shekels on the counter?
We've had some amazing experience of booking plane tickets. You just sort of yank US dollars out of your pants and hope for the best.
Because obviously there aren't necessarily scheduled flights from a place like Goma to a place like
There was one
Juba.
Sort of internal airline called CAA, and our travel agent was this is South Sudan, where we also flew internally. So in South Sudan, our travel agent, I suppose you'd call him, was this enormous South
Morris.
Sudanese
guy. He was about 6
Morris.
Foot 10.
Probably 6 foot 10.
Yeah.
So, before we get to the first idea, I'll tell you the Morris ending. So when we went to the counter to buy the tickets, we put our money down and Kevin's sort of staring at Morris and Morris stands up from his chair and Kevin's eyes sort of just follow him up and like sort of
it's like a monk.
Don't stop for Kevin, who is, you know, he's tall enough, you know, almost broke his neck looking up at this guy. He was enormous.
A monster.
So there's a problem with our ticket when we get to the airport and the Sudanese people are tall, right? We call Morris in a panic. Morris, you got to come help us. We just see him sort of moving through the crowd like a brontosaurus, you know, coming towards the thing and just like helping us and getting everything sorted out.
Oh, wow.
But anyways, we slap down in the middle of Unity State. It's a nightmare there, and it's only gotten worse. And we're driving past the UN mission, the ubiquitous UN mission.
Yeah.
And our driver, kind of the only thing he says, a bunch of UN vehicles whip by us.
Speeding the other way.
He looks back at us and he says dryly, I guess they're late for lunch. You know, and that kind of sums it up.
How did it go so wrong for the UN? I mean, all over the rest of the world, this is regarded as an organization that's meant to keep the peace, that's meant to foster good relations between member nations, that's meant to do humanitarian aid wherever it possibly can in the best and most effective way possible. How did they go from those lofty ambitions to being essentially a new kind of colonial power in parts of Africa where everybody else has no authority? How did this happen?
I think it comes down to Rwanda. When the UN decided that it was going to be an observational entity and watch the genocide unfold, I think that was it. And you see that same sort of mandate instituted elsewhere in the continent where they're literally watching while these things unfold.
But this was after Haiti, so there was, you know,
but
there was context
specifically about Africa, right? So you know, there's really no respect for that institution here in the continent. Very often, where you have these enormous bureaucratic institutions providing services, very often that the government should be providing, they also act as an inhibiting factor for.
Well, they become a new center of power.
This is it. In Ethiopia, we saw how warlords were actually funded by being able to control the food that was dispersed. So, you know, a lot of the favors that the UN does for us here in Africa are controlled by warlords and serve warlords. They don't actually serve the people. So the whole thing sort of folded in on itself. And it really is time to rethink those missions.
It's almost as if Leopold II morphed into Mobutu Sese Seko and Mobutu Sese Seko morphed into this UN mission there. And the people of Zaire, the DRC, have just never been able to shake some kind of yoke. There's always going to be someone in charge of them who trying to screw them over in that part of the Congo anyway.
It's exactly that, Gareth. I mean, Mobutu Sese Seko, once he had nationalized the country, and I mean, this was nationalization on a level that redefines. This is what we're talking about when we talk about...
Is this
about
like when Stalin...
When he put everybody's teaspoons in his own pocket. I mean, he nationalized all the bank accounts and put it in his one Swiss bank account.
Mm.
This was, you know, I mean, that was what he did. And he built a mansion in Cap Ferrat, which was across the bay from King Leopold II's mansion.
Mm-hmm.
So it was exactly that. I mean, it was this mirror.
Mm.
But our story in DRC, I mean, just to move away from the conflict, because, you know, I mean, there were
that wasn't our mandate.
Yeah. our story in the DRC actually upends the idea of the African resource curse.
Okay. What's that curse?
Well, the curse that if you're awash in natural resources, like many African countries are, that the wealth in the ground is not going to be dispersed to the people who live on top of the ground. So we were on a mine in Kibali, in northeastern DRC, about 150 kilometers away from where the Lord's Resistance Army were active. Ituri province was right next door to this territory called Hautwele. And, you know, it was an active conflict zone.
By the way, despite all the social media warriors doing the best they could to unseat the Lord's Resistance Army from their very dangerous position.
They're still doing quite well.
Nothing's happened.
Mm.
All those Twitter and Facebook activists with all of their well-intentioned, you know, nastiness towards the Lord's Resistance Army has resulted in absolutely zero change.
Yeah, because this we is the real context. Yeah, we were in Uganda. It was the most bizarre thing we'd ever experienced.
It was a joke.
It was a joke.
It was a joke amongst the people on the street in Uganda.
The second you fly over their territory to try to find these guys, good luck. Mm. You know, they work in teams of two and three with AKs in a bush the size of South Africa. Well, not quite, but close enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, we'll get them with Twitter.
Yeah. Mm. But anyway, to get back to the story. So a South African company called Randgold Resources are mining the biggest gold deposit that's been discovered in Africa since Witwatersrand. It's a gold deposit of around 40 million ounces in the upward estimate. And these guys have instituted a program where they have taken out $568 million worth of gold in the first quarter, and once they've paid back the capital expenditure, which is $2.5 billion, are going to be paying 52% of their profit in tax back into the Congolese government. Now the development in this area is astounding.
Mm.
They've built a road at their own expense, $8 million. This is the first time that people in this region have been given access to Arua and the Ugandan border. There are businesses springing up, busing companies, and this is a mining company that has delivered what Africans want. I mean, what those local Africans want, and that's development. Everywhere we've been, development and is seen as a good thing.
Well, I mean, in Angola, for example, is a lot of development too.
Well, in Luanda,
in
the rest of it. I mean, this whole journey for us started in Angola in 2006. That's the first sort of spot we're at.
It hasn't really benefited a lot of the people of Angola.
There's no such thing as trickle down.
And it's pretty much a family business, Angola.
It's entirely a family business.
I mean, it's Dos Santos and his
Dos Santos stand. Yeah. That's what Angola is. And you definitely see that, but then you see a developed story like we saw in the DRC where the local government, the national government, and the companies involved were like, let's do this properly.
And it was done properly.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. And this in the DRC, which people are, thanks to Joseph Conrad and everything that's come since, people are so keen to say that the DRC is still, I mean, it should be the most powerful country in Africa. But people are so negative about it.
Yeah, and we felt, I must say, it's a very complicated place and it has lots and lots and lots of challenges. But, you know, you hit a town like Kinshasa and it's just energy.
Mm.
You know, it's just this amazing place full of amazing people. And it's hard to feel completely pessimistic when you're sort of in that context.
I'm jealous of you. I'm jealous of both of you that you get to go to places like Kinshasa.
We're going to take you next.
And Juba.
Mm.
And Lagos. And I mean, I haven't been to these places.
Most South Africans haven't.
And I want to go because I think that they might be a whole lot more interesting than Paris and Rome and London and New York.
No,
without a doubt.
And
without
a doubt. I think you must meet some phenomenal people there and probably have access to some very important people there, right?
We do. I mean, you know, it's amazing when you send an email or make a phone call who in a lot of these countries is willing to speak to you. You know, we've gotten into state houses in a lot of these places, and we've had some really, really interesting, really, really frank discussions. And it's been revelatory. Mm.
Let's talk about what you do in your book regarding South Africa's other obsession, Zimbabwe. For not just white South Africans, but increasingly we see members of kind of the EFF cabal saying that Zimbabwe is a paragon of certain virtues. Mm. Let's talk about that. I mean, what is your observation of Zim in this new perspective of yours that you decided to take on things?
Well, look, I mean, Zimbabwe's not a paragon of anything. Let's just start there. And then let's go into the qualifications.
Hey, I'm trying to open it up for you. You decide the parameters.
So what was unsurprising was we got reviewed in the Financial Times. It was a relatively good review, but they had big issues with our Zimbabwe reading. Mm-hmm. Because the lens, and again it's the Western lens that gets imposed on Zimbabwe is the big fuck up that is Zimbabwe has everything to do with the land reform process. Mm. Not entirely true.
Yeah. What else is it?
Yeah, the facts. 6,000 white commercial farmers have with massive tracts of land. We're talking 1980. Now, those massive tracts of land are divided amongst 245,000 smallholders.
Mm-hmm.
The myth is that this land has been rendered totally infertile, that there's erosion, that the land is dead, mm-hmm. that it's been overfarmed. The truth is up until 2014, this land was delivering agricultural output that was on a par with what the agricultural output was in the early 90s. Now, there's a hell of a lot of deep research.
And it was, what, subsistence farming, so there wasn't necessarily...
Not only that.
Yes, it was starting to become smallholder commercial farming.
And until the drought, the tobacco farms were supplying at big profits for about 1 or 2 years, 2013, 2014, uh-huh. to China. And we saw this industry coming back. And it's a narrative that doesn't fit with the likes of the FT or The Economist because... So many thousands of words have gone into telling the opposite story. Now, the broader context there is something like Operation Hakuzokwe, Operation You Will Not Return. 2008 in the Morangi Diamond Fields, the Zimbabwean military and the Zimbabwean police went in there with helicopter gunships and sort of strafed the locals and basically instituted a forced labor. A slavery sort of campaign in this region where you can't get out of there. You'll get searched for the diamonds on your person and all of this money. There's a big blood funnel. There's a money sack where this money is going into the British Virgin Isles. It's a big farrago.
Obviously administered by some very greedy politicians.
By some very greedy politicians and by some pretty smart sort of gangsters. One guy by the name of Sam Parr, who's notorious across Southern Africa.
And he must be in cahoots with some of these politicians.
Of course he is. Yeah.
So he returns some of the profits.
Angola and Zimbabwe. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Yeah. It's
quite
a
network.
That's a big place. That's too nice.
What kind of life does this guy lead?
Well, right now we believe he's
in
a prison
in
Beijing. Yeah, well, not Beijing, in mainland China.
I like that. It's kind of just come up.
But look, you know, one of the things that's very confusing to people is land reform and or farm invasions, whatever you want to call them, destroyed the Zimbabwean economy. Okay, so leaving that aside, the Zimbabwean economy came to complete pieces, right? Land reform, farm invasions were working for a number of commercial smallholding farmers. Mm-hmm. They were, right? The economy is, in a weird way, kind of a separate issue and has been completely mismanaged. And, of course, they're pegged, they run the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Now that the dollar's value has raised, the Zimbabwean economy is coming to pieces at a rate that is just insane. So in a weird way, it's kind of necessary to separate these two issues. But we came to the conclusion that ZANU is the most perfect ZANU it can possibly be. At liberation, they understood themselves to be Zimbabwe, right? In the whole conception of how ZANU saw things, there was no one else. Mm. There was no ZAPU.
No.
You know, there was no notion of...
Nkomo was in the way. They got rid of him quickly enough.
You know, you had the Matabele land massacres. Yeah. You had all of that stuff that sort of cleared this conceptual notion of the borders of Zimbabwe representing the borders of ZANU.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not land reform was a good idea or a bad idea...
It was a ZANU idea.
Well, no, it actually was the war veterans' idea. It was not, and this is what so many people are confused about, it was not a Mugabe initiative.
Hmm.
Mugabe was like, hell no.
Oh, really?
And so, yeah, absolutely. And the war vets were like, buddy, and that's exactly what's happening again.
I mean,
now.
The context for that, again, is the IMF. It's the Structural Adjustment Program.
Sure,
It comes 1992, these guys, because they've got an economy now, that is totally upended. The economy was for what? Four million whites?
Yes.
You know, 300,000 whites. Yeah. It was just set up for 300,000 mm-hmm. whites. Now you've got an economy that needs to service
20 million people.
The majority. Mm-hmm.
And as you end up with less and less and less, as the economy starts to deteriorate, you get more and more desperate people.
And you have to take loans from the IMF, and the IMF says, we'll give you this loan, but you have to cut back on your private sector. So 60,000 people
on the public sector.
So 60,000 people in the public sector lose their jobs. You've then got riots on the streets of Harare in 96, 97. What can Mugabe do to stay in power? He can offer the land.
Mm. But the war vets were like, it's time. You said at liberation we got the land. Where's the land? And Mugabe was like, well, we don't mess with the land. We don't do that. But they did. He had to. Otherwise, he would have lost power. Right? So that's the kind of interesting context that so many people miss about Zimbabwe. It was like, then one day Mugabe started hitting white farmers on the head, and that was the end of the country.
Yeah.
Way more complicated.
And never mind Lancaster House. Never mind what the Brits promised
in terms of
the land,
But those stories we have heard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is new. I mean, this is a new perspective on the whole thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's certainly not. Yeah, there's lots of research out there. I wouldn't say we've kind of broken anything in this regard.
I think what we have done new is we actually interviewed people in ZANU.
Right.
Peter Godwin doesn't.
Mm.
At all.
Mm-hmm.
So you go into...
They've got a line.
And the line gets them a lot of money writing for Vanity Fair, and they sell a lot of books to the Wenwis.
Wenwis being the ex-Rhodesians.
Yeah.
All right. Now, Namibia is interesting to me. Small population, very complex, but actually almost binary in terms of its political choices and options. You've got some tribal considerations, Herero and Ovambo and that kind of thing, but it's not really. I mean, it's a kind of country that it just carries. It just ticks over. Stuff sort of happens. It seems there's very little in the way of contestation for power. There's very little in the way of controversy. What's going on in Namibia? It's one of the countries you focused on.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we'd sort of disagree with that because there's a lot of sort of struggles that are happening under the water. There's a couple of really good journalists there who have done amazing work in covering a number of really kind of gruesome corruption scandals. The presidential palace, which Kevin and I were...
Anytime a president has a palace, it's usually a bad
sign. Palace is a bad word.
Palace is bad, right.
Mm. But this thing is a palace. It was shocking when we saw it because we hadn't been to Windhoek, I think, in about 7 years, mm. 6 years, five mm. years.
Who's in charge there? Because the last time I checked, it was Hifikepunye Pohamba.
There's been a there's been a shift in.
Who's this now?
He's another SWAPU fella, and sort of semi well regarded.
What kind of hat does he wear? Because in Africa, it's also important that various leaders make their statement by wearing a hat. You know, we've got. The president of South Sudan.
Salva Kiir. That's the most famous hat.
He wears the Stetson.
The 10-gallon Stetson. Yeah.
We've got Tanzania. What's his name?
The new guy. I don't
know. No. That's not Tanzania. I'm thinking of... Is it Uganda? Yeah. Uganda. Museveni. He wears his hat.
Yeah.
We've got various kinds of hats coming out of Nigeria.
I don't think Southern Africa. I don't think we do hats.
We don't have hats.
Yeah, we need to do hats.
We need to get our own hats. Mm. I mean, we've got
all,
to have
all like a Trump hairstyle. I mean, yeah. Now with all these demagogues and
what about
in
like
the West?
A thing like Mango Sutubuthelezi War when he jammed the signal in Parliament? That's the kind of thing we should.
Yeah,
maybe
yeah,
start.
That's, yeah. That, yeah.
Let's do that. All right. So this guy's another SWAPO dude.
Yeah, he's another. Well, I mean, he's not going to come from anywhere else.
No,
I mean,
of course.
There's the, you know. So what we were looking at there was the construction industry, where a lot of growth has been driven from construction, actually, not so much mining. This was at least, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And SWAPO was kind of at war with the main construction union, which was saying, okay, you brought all these Chinese companies, you're giving these Chinese companies tenders, they're underbilling by 10, 11 million rand on every single project. And what you're saying to us is that all of the progressive labor legislation that we fought for at Liberation by your side, all of that has to go out the window.
So we can make money out of China.
So all of these Chinese companies can build government tenders.
And screw over our own workers.
Exactly. Oh. So that was the conflict that we were looking at.
But you were saying the presidential palace, since we're
so
talking
construction. We arrive in Windhoek. We go take a look at the presidential palace, and perhaps unwisely, started snapping pictures. It was night. The moon was high. And a van screeches up. And four thugs, there was no other way to describe them, leap out of the van. Okay?
They're not locals.
Not locals. These were guys from the Maghreb. They were speaking, you know, thick Arab accents. These were guns for hire.
In Namibia.
In Namibia. Okay? This is in Windhoek. What are you doing? Well, we're taking pictures of the palace. Would you do that in your country? Yep. We would. Lots of people do. It got real, real hairy. We thought we were going to get a proper smack and we're going to get kicked out of the country. This was the first day on the road, okay, for the proper research element
in
of this.
Namibia,
the question becomes where the paranoia comes from.
I'm looking at your list here. Namibia and Botswana have to have been the most peaceful, chilled, relaxed that
the
you were.
The first day in Namibia, we almost got a camera inserted in the...
In some other orifice. God, I can't believe this. Mm.
Yeah, and what we certainly had noticed in the 5 years since we'd been there was this uptick in paranoia. This notion that, you know, we have to sort of close ranks. We have to sort of be, you know, more Chinese.
Okay, well, now the Chinese
are... Well, that's
are
the link, yeah.
Okay, the Chinese are a massive influence, and we've only got couple of minutes left. Let's just focus on them for a second, because if we don't, there are two dangers in Africa, and you can correct me wherever you think I'm misstepping here, guys. Please, you've got the experience, you've written the book. Problem number one is there is a spread of dangerous militant Islam down the east and west coast of Africa. We've seen the results. We've seen that mall in Kenya most recently. We've seen Boko Haram and the girls. And those are just the ones that get the newspaper headlines. We know that in Central Africa, this is also the major issue. These are the big geopolitical trends. The other one is China. China's massively involved in Mozambique, in Angola, in Southwest Africa or Namibia, in Zimbabwe, in Zambia. China is pretty much taking whatever it wants resource-wise. They're paying handsomely for it, but only handsomely to those who are willing to control the supply and demand for and on behalf of them. Am I wrong on any of that?
You're right, but let's say two things about China. So the infrastructure for resources swap model, which is,
in other words, we come in, we'll build you a highway, you let us fish your seas dry.
Exactly. A lot of African countries have got screwed by the below par, construction sort of standard. A lot of roads are crumbling. There's a dam in Botswana that is sort of just scraping through. Sinohydro got kicked out of Botswana. But we're moving into a second phase now. And the second phase, we know that China understand that they can't send their junior engineers to Africa anymore. Certainly not to countries like Botswana, because they will get kicked out. Hmm. What China has delivered to Africa mainly is a choice. No longer is it just the West. No longer do we have to accept the IMF structural adjustment programs. We can – and Meles Zenawi was a master at playing the West off against China – Now, Melezenawi had his problems. He had more journalists in prison than any other guy. But if more African leaders can sort of take the cue from Zenawi and play the West off against China in the years going forward,
we'll get better deals.
We'll get better deals because China's going nowhere. We're now going
1.4 billion people. Yeah. We should probably be dealing with them.
Yeah,
it would be it's market.
It's a market.
That's all it is, if nothing else. And if they want our resources, sure, but we got to sell them at a fair price.
100%, and it's amazing in our experience how quickly the Chinese bend.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they'll push issues like the Dalai Lama, but when it comes to even the minor suggestion that they're being colonialist in their behavior, they flip.
Really?
They're like, okay, how can we reframe this?
I like this. This is probably a piece of very significant good news.
It is. The Chinese African engagement is just this massive generational epochal coming together. It's very, very good ultimately for this continent.
I suppose again we like to box people and we like to say, well, the Chinese are coming in, they're just a new kind of colonialist. And they're just a new kind of punitive.
Who runs African countries? Africans. You know, it comes down to how you're going to institute your governance principles. That's all.
We've met senior Chinese ambassadors, the guys who actually run China policy, who understand African nuance more, you know, deeper and better and more comprehensively than most Africa hands we've met. Because they actually stay on the continent for decades and decades. So they're holding this knowledge. And that's being passed through to the second generation. The top Chinese universities, and I've been to one of them, that have African Studies Department.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they know about this Botswana issue. They've been on the ground there. They know they can't continue to operate like this.
I can guarantee you they don't know or care about it at the Sorbonne.
No, not to the same extent. Yeah, there's a real arrogance that comes out of those institutions, which you don't see matched with the Chinese. We've never met an arrogant Chinese envoy. I mean, a guy who's like, well, this is how it is.
We have not.
But you've met lots of French, English, American.
Oh, my gosh.
Right.
Yeah.
And UN.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. So basically, guys, the UN must get out. Let's do the right deals with China, not the wrong ones. There are certain countries that you think are safe that might not be. There's paranoia setting in some of these places. I mean, the book is full of all kinds of really interesting revelations of that nature. Well done. Continental Shift is what it's called. It's Richard Poplack. It's Kevin Bloom. And it's available at all good bookstores now. Help them to drink up the profits of this book by buying it liberally everywhere for your friends and family and giving it as gifts.
And don't take the Western media as gospel.
No.
Please.
Definitely not.
Absolutely not. I mean, if this is our continent, let's at least start looking at it from our own point of view. Thank you, gentlemen. Very nice to meet you both this morning.
Thanks for having us.
Congratulations on the book. There we go. It's called Continental Shift. Make sure you find out where to get it and get it. Don't stand in the shop and browse like those cheap people who try to read a chapter every day because they don't want to pay for the goddamn book. Go for the free coffee or something. All right? Stop being cheap. CliffCentral.com.